The Conservatives are the largest party. They don't have an overall majority at this stage. The Prime Minister called this election because she wanted certainty and stability. This doesn't seem to look like certainty and stability.
Welcome to Polling Politics. This episode is sponsored by Smarkets. I'm Joe Twyman, co-founder and director of Delta Poll.
And I'm freelance journalist Marie LeConte.
Our guest this week is Michael Crick, writer, broadcaster and political journalist. Michael is the political correspondent for Channel 4 News and his new book is Sultan of Swing, The Life of David Butler. Hello, Michael.
Hello.
Now, Michael studied PPE at New College, Oxford before joining ITN as a trainee journalist. He's worked for ITV, the BBC and as Newsnight's political editor, where essentially, Michael, you're famous for running after people. Would this be a fair characterisation?
Well, I suppose I'm quite well known for doing that. In a way, I wish I was well known for other things. That's partly why I wrote this book. But every now and then I run after someone. Everybody gets in a tiz about it and gets excited about it. But most of my life, I'm not actually running after people.
But how do you feel about the fact that it's become a word, that it's become a phrase, someone got cricked? So I've definitely heard that before.
Yes, indeed. One of my producers deliberately put that word about. He said, right, we're going to make you famous, Michael. We're going to...
Producers.
and so it sort of happened, but I don't think it's in any dictionary yet, nor is it ever likely to be.
I do know that. I remember actually like a friend worked on the Conservative election campaign in 2017, and there were a few events where there was one person in the press team on Crick Watch. So actually,
indeed, I was told about that afterwards, yes. And indeed, on one occasion, we spotted who it was. It was when Theresa made her famous social care speech, you know, the one where she U-turned in Gresford, just outside Wrexham. And because that was such a big story, we weren't able to use the material whereby we spotted who it was and said, what are you doing here? Why are you following us? What do you want? You know? But the poor young lady, she was, I think she was a bit worried about what they'd say when she got back, that we'd found her out.
The first thing we'd like to talk about is the second referendum, the people's vote, however you want to characterise it.
Or the third referendum, if you're as old as me.
Yeah. This
is. I remember the first.
This is true. The polling before this weekend's march was actually relatively stable. You have a little more people opposing than supporting, around about 45% opposing, 39% supporting. It'd be interesting to see whether that has changed. And 30% of the population think that a second referendum is very unlikely. 5% think it's very likely. Michael, after all that's happened, where do you stand? What do you think will happen?
What do I think will happen? I think there's probably about a 20-25% chance there would be a second or third referendum or people's vote. Well, that's just propaganda. Let's call it what it is. It's a second or third referendum. Let's go for second. And then what would happen in the referendum? Well, I think it's 50-50, actually. It could go either way. And, I mean, there is a history of sort of when people get asked a question again, they sort of reinforce the answer they gave the first time round, like the famous Winchester election where the result was overturned because there was a, that's right, the Conservatives lost by 2. So they challenged the result and found some irregularities. So they reran the election. And the second time round, rather than winning by 2 votes, the Liberal Democrats won by 21,000. So from the Remainers' point of view, that would be a disaster. I mean, that would reinforce Brexit for... Well, actually, I've given up making forecasts, but for quite a long time. And I think there also is another factor here, is that what effect does this have on respect for democracy and democratic institutions? And if, say, the Remainers were to win, say, 51-49, the Brexiteers would undoubtedly call for a third game or a fourth or fifth. I just think it could get very messy.
I completely agree. I think there's a real risk. And also the polling around this is interesting because, of course, it depends on what question you ask, both in terms of the polling and what question would be asked in a second referendum. And there doesn't as yet seem to be an agreed answer to that. About
you've got the whole range of options of Brexit that you could ask about. Then you could ask, well, what about No Deal? And then you could ask about Remain. So there are at least five options that you could ask people, and then it could get exceedingly complicated. But the people campaigning for this say that they're confident they can think of ways around it. You know, it is a possibility, I suppose. And, you know, there is a history of this happening in Europe that you don't like what people have said the first time round, so you ask them again.
This wasn't it, because I think that was the Justin Greening idea of having three options of either, like, May's deal, No Deal, or Remain, which presumably would split the Leave vote, and actually, you know, Remain would probably win. But I'm not, again, you know, I agree. I think that I can't see a scenario in which that would change anything or like make anything better or less messy.
On the other hand, can any of us think of how the government, Theresa May or whatever government exists, is going to get out of this mess? I mean, I think a general election is even less likely. I suppose.
So you think a general election is less likely than a second referendum? In terms of coming first?
I don't see how the House of Commons votes for a second general election. I mean, the Conservatives did that last year, and look what happened. They're terrified that Corbyn, you know, is a great campaigner, and they do all lose their seats. And furthermore, it would be a general election on the existing boundaries rather than the new ones, which may or may not eventually go through. So I think that the idea of a general, I mean, obviously Labour, you know, are gung-ho about it and think, well, they pretend to think it's going to happen. But I don't see how it would happen and how you get the votes in the House of Commons for it. Now, in the old days, of course, when you didn't have the Fixed-Term Parliaments Act and all sorts of rules, and governments were much more sort of you know, honourable about these things, and if they were defeated, they sort of felt, well, we better go to the country. It might have happened, but not these days.
Not since Lord Carrington is always the answer about these things. The language around Theresa May particularly has been, well, shall we say, deteriorating of late, and this weekend, perhaps you could argue, marked a new low. There was discussion about her, quote, entering the killing zone. She was described as a lame cockroach in an irradiated environment. At one point, somebody was quoted, an anonymous source was quoted as saying, the knife gets heated, stuck in her front and twisted, she'll be dead soon. And these are her own team. I mean, to say, it's almost a cliche to say, and her enemies were less kind. In terms of polling, she's actually not doing that badly.
No, this is the remarkable thing. It's the one thing she's got going for her.
A third of people think she's doing well.
Yes, and they prefer her to the other Conservative options. They prefer her to Corbyn. And it's the one thing where she can say, well, at least the people out there seem to respect me for what I'm doing.
Or at least the people out there seem to hate me less than my own party.
And I think actually she is, and there is a sense out there, oh, just get on with this Brexit thing. Some people don't like Brexit, but they still want the government to get on with it. And I think she, you know, that is behind her in a way. I mean, it's not overwhelming, but for a prime minister a year and a half into their term of office, she's doing, the polls are pretty good in it for her. And actually, very disappointing for Jeremy Corbyn and Labour, who spend a lot of time not saying very much about any of this.
But also, yeah, I think that coming back to the language backbench Tory MPs are kind of using against her, what strikes me is that that did not work. So Labour moderate MPs did that against Corbyn for ages. And basically what we found is that people, when actually didn't really like Corbyn, but this seems unfair, like he's under attack for things that he might or might not have done, I feel quite bad for him. So as a result, I quite like him. And they're doing exactly the same thing now. And I wonder if there's not a level as well in terms of like the public just going, actually, you know, everyone's being absolutely awful to her when she just seems to be doing what, you know, like trying her best and that's it. So I don't think that's actually like beyond the idea. I think that it is quite tasteless to talk about your leader in that way. But also I'm not sure that's going to work really or help them.
It was a bit like Salzburg, actually. There was a reaction in that helped her. And I think that happened yesterday. And everybody got up in the House and virtually every MP who got out and asked their question prefaced it with this, first of all, we must condemn the language and all of that. And I couldn't help feeling I wouldn't be surprised if you were one of them. And indeed, I think some of the people who were saying some of these things were probably quite surprising people, actually. And also, some of the things they said in print look terrible, but it's the tone in which they said them. If they said them sort of in a jokey, laughing kind of way, it may not have been anything like as bad as it looks in print. People said it was misogynistic. I don't know about that. I mean, people would have said these things about male prime ministers, surely.
You've worked in politics since the 1980s and studied it for a lot longer. Can you remember such language being used about a leader?
Well, I can't in terms of specifics, no, but I'm sure they did. and maybe you know, maybe journalists were slightly less willing to report it some of the time. I'm not sure that this is a new level, but I think, you know, it's actually come to her rescue in a strange way.
Speaking of people in need of rescue, Nick Clegg, he, for our younger listeners, used to be a politician. And he was of course former Lib Dem leader and deputy prime minister. In fact, I think he's Sir Nick Clegg.
Yes, I don't even remember him getting that.
No, well, he got it when Cameron left, and Sir Linton Crosby and Sir Craig Oliver were all knighted. And so Sir Nick Clegg is off to be Facebook's Vice President of Global Affairs and Communications. I think it's amazing that he's just Vice President. Does that mean David Cameron's going to be hired as President? Because that would be
David Cameron, it seems, rather desperate for a job at the moment. Actually, that's a very, I mean, quite apart from the dangers of going and working for Facebook, and I think they are quite large, if there was to be a second referendum, who would lead the Remain side? So many of the people have deserted
Gary Lineker. This has been well established.
But I mean, Nick Clegg has been doing a lot of town hall meeting type Remain meetings around the country, and apparently he's very good and very effective. And we're now seeing again the Nick Clegg of 2010. Although I think, you know, he was discredited by the coalition in the public mind and the mind of many young people, that maybe it's impossible for him to ever recover his previous popularity. But presumably he would not be available if he's now working for Facebook and in California.
Well, it's funny you should say that, because just after his apology, do you remember the apology that he issued in 2012, basically saying sorry about the tuition fees and all that sort of thing? Even in the aftermath of that, more people thought he was likable than dislikable. Yes, only a quarter thought he was trustworthy, and only 1 in 10 thought he was strong. But he has got something to build on. But you're right, if he's off to Facebook, then one assumes that means he's locked out of that.
It's remarkable, Nick Clegg. Nick Clegg was the most successful Liberal leader since Lloyd George in terms of getting into government. And yet, electorally, he was the least successful Liberal leader since, before Lloyd George. In that he never won a by-election. I think that's right. And he lost nearly all the Lib Dem seats.
Jack Blanchard at Politico has helpfully curated a list of all of the former Politicos who now work for the big tech companies: Google, Facebook, Amazon, Twitter, Uber, Deliveroo. They've all hired former special advisors, former peers from all sides of the political spectrum. Is this the shape of things to come, do you think?
Well, obviously, these people pay very good salaries. So that's one reason why this might happen. And the other thing is that there's a terrible trend in politics these days, that people, as soon as they lose an election, admittedly, Nick Clegg lost his seat as well, they desert the battlefield. Whereas in the old days, you know, Winston Churchill lost his seat, Ramsay MacDonald lost their seat, they just look for the next by-election and work their way back in. Or they lose a general election, they'd work their way back in. Now, they seem to be in Parliament in order to be in government. They're not very interested in being backbenchers. They're not very interested in being in opposition. And as soon as the opportunity arises, then they're off. In Clegg's case, and Blair and Cameron's case, they haven't even gone to the House of Lords. Partly because, of course, you then have to declare your earnings, or at least where you're getting it from. It is a trend. And what it means is that the House of Commons loses a lot of wisdom. I mean, even Nick Clegg has some wisdom. And there are very few sort of real greybeards around the House of Commons compared with what they used to be. And, you know, just getting an old-timer who'd been Chancellor of the Exchequer 30 years ago to get up and give his opinion on something was worth listening to. And now there's nobody seems interested in doing that, because partly because they've got all these attractive jobs outside, and partly because they have to declare in much more detail what they earn and where from.
But on that point as well, I think that isn't age, I think, quite a massive thing as well, where actually, you know, the generation since Blair and up to, you know, before May and Corbyn, they were just very young leaders, chancellors, leaders of the opposition. And
Osborne was 33 when he was shadow.
So I can see it, but I think it's genuinely really interesting, because we've not had that before. The kind of, you know, people who actually, yeah, like, they might be in their mid, late 40s, and they're kind of done in politics. They're not going to rise to the top again.
Oh, yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean,
what do you do? Like, you still have a lifetime ahead of you. And I think that might be why as well. It's a new trend in the sense that we'd not not had it before because they're just young. And I do have some sympathy for the idea of saying, yeah, let's say I'm 46, 47, I'm not going to just spend the rest of my life in the House of Commons, House of Lords. I can just have an entire other career afterwards.
Indeed. And I agree entirely. And indeed, you've got three prime ministers, I think, in a row, Blair, Brown and Cameron, who all retired in their 50s. I mean, some of them barely 50. Mm. And these are people whose minds will be good for another 30 years, whereas people might have retired in their 50s 100 years ago, but they probably only lived to be 70, and people age much more quickly. So it's perfectly understandable. And in fact, this is a trend in society as a whole. I think we're going to see a lot more career, well, probably already are doing, and I've just not noticed it, and I've not managed to do it myself, but there are a lot more career switching in your 50s, because you've got 30 years worth of brain power, and there's a limit to how much you can do in retirement.
And speaking of age, it's worth pointing out that Nick Clegg is the same age as Nigel Farage, which is a point that is sometimes forgotten.
I didn't know that.
I'm the same age as Paul Nuttall. it's truly amazing what a diet of UKIP will do to you. We're joined now for our regular chat with Subject from Smarket. Subject, hello.
Hi, how are you doing?
Yeah, we're doing well. Now, earlier we discussed the march in London for the second referendum. Has that march changed any of the betting patterns around the likelihood of a second EU referendum?
Well, it was a good, lively march with lots of people, but it has not moved our markets as of yet. We're still strongly saying that there won't be a second referendum based on the people's vote. Last traded result was about 86%. So it's pretty strongly saying no, regardless of the march.
And March 29th still looks like the date that's going to be settled on for Britain leaving the EU. Has that changed at all?
Not at all, I'm afraid. From January to April 2019 for the leave date, it's 67% at the moment. It's been the top since the beginning of that market, and it's not changed. The next possible date is May to August 2018. 12%, but so that looks really unlikely.
And of course, before all of that, we have the US midterms coming up. Is there a particular race that we should be looking at for this? Say the Texas 31st?
Oh, wow, yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking about. I mean, it must be all on our minds. Now, we've had a lot of money traded on that particular market, and it's a really interesting race. I mean, obviously, again, Texas is a red state, so it's likely to go Republican, but the recent showings have maybe put that into question. We've got Mary Jennings, MJ Hegar, who is a Air Force pilot who used to pilot helicopters for the Democrats. And she's recently been polling as the favorite against John Carter, who's a district court judge for Williamson County in Texas. He's the incumbent since 2003, and he should, by all rights, win this race. And according to our markets, he should win the race. But recent polling has actually put him in second place to MJ Hegar.
Fantastic. And so there's still all to play for in that contest.
Yeah, I mean, we've got a really tight race with 10% undecided at the moment. MJ is on 46% versus Carter at 44%. So it could actually swing either way on that. And our markets are strongly saying that the incumbent will win, but actually could go the other way.
And what about further afield? Is there anything really on the edges that we should be looking out for? In Australia, for instance, he said, randomly speculating.
Well, that is incredible. I can't believe the chance of you asking me that. Wentworth by-election is the one we've all been watching.
Now, and just to clarify, Wentworth was very popular during the 1980s as the location for seminal Australian drama Prisoner Cell Block H. I imagine I'm the only person who remembers this.
But I have no idea what you're on about.
It's nothing to do with that, is it?
I don't think it is, no. It's more to do with Malcolm Turnbull, who used to be the Liberal Party leader and the Prime Minister of Australia. He was ousted recently by Scott Morrison and then resigned his seat, which caused a by-election. Kerrin Phillips has just won that as an independent, with 76% last traded on our markets. And Australia now has a position of a minority government in power. Scott Morrison's an interesting guy. He had a really great quote in Australia. If you don't mind, I'll just read it to you. He said, "If you have a go in this country, you will get a go. There is a fair go for those who have a go. That is what fairness in Australia means. We have come to have a go, and we will get a fair go." And that really kind of summarizes neatly the Australian political scene, because they've had four prime ministers in the last 5 years.
I was going to say, so presumably it's only a matter of time before another prime minister takes part, possibly by the end of the week.
Well, exactly. I mean, Scott Morrison may not be the leader of the Liberal Party for much longer. And we've got a market on the next Liberal leader, or the person who will be the next Liberal leader at the time of the next general election. At the moment, our market is still saying Scott Morrison's going to be there, but actually this could change quite considerably.
Fantastic. Well, thank you, Sarwjit. We will catch up with you again next week.
Thanks very much.
Another story away from Westminster that's attracted a lot of attention is the murder of Jamal Khashoggi in the Turkish embassy. The Saudis, it's fair to say, have not covered themselves in glory when it's come to explanations of this, with weeks of speculating about what had happened. Now, even before the, if you like, reform agenda of Mohammed bin Salman, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, 39% of Britons regarded Saudi Arabia as an enemy. Only 37% regarded them as an ally. And the most recent situation, I doubt, has done anything to improve that. CNN legal analyst Renato Mariotti described it best, I think, when he said, "No honest person with common sense believes that a 59-year-old journalist entered an embassy, picked a fight with many young men who were armed with a bone saw, and was so violent that they had no choice but to hack him into small pieces." Do we think the relationship between Britain and Saudi Arabia will change as a result of this? Or do you think it'll just be a lot of noise but nothing ultimately?
The general pattern seems to be, I mean, it's the same with Russia, isn't it? We come out with lots of words, we come out with some mildish sanctions of one kind or another, and two or three years later, things are pretty much back to normal. The trouble is, Saudi Arabia is so important to us strategically and in terms of intelligence and jobs. So I can't see this government behaving in any differently from the way it's treated the Russians over the years.
But also, I feel like on a smaller point, like, I was quite interested in how long it took Liam Fox to actually say he was not going to Davos in the desert. Like, it took Tom Tugendhat and quite a lot of like other senior MPs going, "This would be a terrible idea, like, come on." And like several days, I think, of that before eventually Liam Fox, you know, the Department of International Trade said, okay, yeah, fine, you know, he is not going. And it took that bit too long, which I think might be indicative of things to come.
But it's often remarkable to me how Saudi Arabia is treated differently in terms of the context of these things. I mean, when people talk about Mohammed bin Salman's reforms, they point to the fact that, oh, well, women are now allowed to drive, as if that's a thing. Although I have to say, having worked in that region, I would ban Saudi women from driving, but I would extend it right to ban Saudi men as well. I don't think any Saudis should be allowed to drive.
Just...
They are. Yeah, it's quite an incredible country for driving.
It's, oh no, Morocco is the same. Like, there is literally like a saying, I think, not just in my family, Morocco in general, saying, you know, Moroccan people don't drive, they just avoid other cars.
In Egypt, I was in a taxi where someone talked about the guidelines that the traffic lights provided, which I thought was interesting. Michael, we are delighted to have you in this week to talk about your new book. Now, you've previously written books on, among others, Arthur Scargill, Alex Ferguson, Michael Heseltine, and most famously, Jeffrey Archer. So when I heard that you were writing a book about the life of David Butler, I immediately thought, oh my God, what's he done wrong? For those that don't know, David Butler is really the godfather of political science in this country. So tell us, who is Sir David Butler?
Well, Sir David Butler is the man who really made elections in this country numerate. He's the father of what we call sophology, the study of elections. And it all flows from his work in 1945, when he was still only a student at Oxford. And he was always, as a boy, he was always interested in politics and current affairs, and he always loved playing with figures and cricket stats. He could change a batsman or a bowler's average while the game was going on, ball by ball. He was at New College during the war, and then he went off to fight. And then when he came back in the summer of 45, Wisden that year was a bit thin because there wasn't much county cricket. And so he bought the Times Guide to the House of Commons for the election that had just occurred in July 45, and all the results he noticed were just raw figures. So it'd be Twyman 14,605, Crick 11,000. 501, and no percentages. And he thought, well, I wonder what the percentages are. So he went through with his slide rule, which I probably haven't come across a slide rule, but it's a little device with for working before the
calculator. I've seen it in museums.
And worked out all the percentages for all the candidates in 1945. And then he did the same for the three previous elections in 1935, 31 and 29. And then noticed that if the Labour vote went up by 6%, say, in Exeter, it tended to go up by 6% in other places. And so he developed this idea of swing and uniform swing. And having put the election results into percentages, which, believe it or not, nobody had ever done before in Britain or America.
This sounds so strange when you say it. I mean, it's like another world.
I'm quite cross. Obvious. I could have come up with that.
Seems so obvious. And now we've checked all the directories and the New York Times. The New York Times didn't put American congressional results into percentages until 1952. So they were faster than we were in Britain. And the Times Guide didn't do it until 1959. Anyway, there was David doing this. And he was still only an undergraduate. He hadn't got his degree yet. He couldn't vote because he was only 20 and the voting age was 21 then. And he started the science of what became known as sophology.
And he was the person that popularised that term.
He did, although he didn't actually invent it.
This is a point of some controversy.
The word is based on the Greek word sephos, which in both modern and ancient Greek means pebble. And that's how the ancient Greeks used to vote, by putting a pebble in an urn or somewhere. And so, hence, sophology. And this was the story has always been that this was an Oxford High Table joke, dreamt up by some classicists. At Oxford, we discovered that it was actually devised at a weekly meeting of a famous Oxford Literary Society called the Inklings, and that C.S. Lewis, the author, seems to have been involved because there was a letter from one of David Butler's colleagues saying, "I was at a meeting of Lewis and the Choice Spirits today, and they said this word you use, electionology, we can't use that. That's laughable. How about sophology instead?" And that's how the term was invented way back in 1949.
How annoying do you have to be at university to think, "I don't like this word, I'm just going to make up another word. We have decided as a group to change this word." There you go.
Well, it happens all the time, isn't it? I mean, students are always coming up with new words and phrases. I can't keep up with them.
Now, a couple of weeks ago, we had Phil Cowley in, who's the editor of the British General Election book for 2017. But it was David Butler who worked on this series from 1945 to 2005.
That's right.
I mean, it's an incredible body of work.
Well, he first set out his findings his theories of swing, the extent to which the vote changes between one election and the next election. And that was in the 1945 edition when he was still a student. He didn't actually edit the book, but it was the most important part of the book. And then from 51 onwards, he edited the book and later co-edited it right up until 2005. So more than 50 years, and every election he'd be studying it and going around seeing all the key players, both before the election, during the election, and after the election. And then very, very quickly, rather more quickly than Mr. Cowley has, he would get the book out, often by the end of that year. I have some sympathy with Phil, though, on this, on his latest book, because the general election of 2017 is the... No. Well, I don't know if he's lazy. I don't think so. I've got no evidence for that. But it was the most complicated general election, I think, since the war. And so much going on in different directions.
When he was on here, he did defend how Dennis Kavanagh and David Butler were able to produce two books in 1974 and how that was far more difficult than just one in 2017.
Well, I mean, some general elections are barely worth... I mean, the 2001 election, for instance, where the result barely changed.
You needed a pamphlet, really. You didn't need a full book. But in political science terms, I would argue his most influential book is Political Change in Britain, which he co-wrote with Don Stokes.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
Well, Don Stokes was an American, and he'd been involved in work at Michigan, where they had this rolling panel of voters that they would go back to every 2 years and interview them about their voting habits, why they voted. You know, they'd interview them for an hour and a half, about asking them all the same questions, of course, about their backgrounds, how their parents voted, did they belong to a trade union, all of that. And David teamed up with a member of this Michigan team, Donald Stokes, and did the same in Britain, starting their surveys in 1963. And it resulted in this book, Political Change in Britain, which came out in 69, which really gave people a much better understanding of why people vote the way they do. And since then, there's been this rolling panel known as the British Election Study, which has carried on ever since. So you've got this data dating back all the way back to 1963, and many of the same questions in each questionnaire. And so you get this, you can build up this picture of how people's opinions have changed over the years and the influences on those opinions. And their book was the start of this, and is regarded as the all-time classic of why people vote the way they do.
And the write-up in The Times referred to young people being Labour's secret strength.
Yes. Well, they got it rather wrong. It was funny. It's one of those books that, at the time, got some pretty horrid reviews. And it was only later that actually people came to the conclusion it was rather a good book. But there was
just like The Hunger Games.
That's right. There was a serialisation. It wasn't... The Sunday Times sort of did a pre-seed version under Butler and Stokes's name, under this heading, Labour's Secret Strength. And the idea was that for the rest of the 20th century, Labour would become more and more powerful, but as Conservative voters died out, and new young people came onto the electoral register, and of course all young people vote Labour, being the theory.
Does that sound familiar? as a relatively young entrant to British politics, does that ring a bell?
Anyway, this proved to be disastrously wrong, because if you take the eight general elections from 1970 onwards, one of them, in 1970 is only 8 months after the book came out. Well, the Conservatives won the popular vote in seven of them, so you can't always assume that trends will carry on the way that they have been doing. And these people who say, oh, well, it won't be long before we have a Brexit majority and all the Brexiters die out, or it won't be long before we have a permanent Labour majority, they've got to remember that actually people change their views, events occur, new ideas. You know, the advent of Thatcherism is obviously a key reason why the Butler and Stokes thesis didn't really work out, and other things too.
For nearly 70 years, David Butler has been what's been described as a bridge between the world of academia and the real world. You talked about the fact that he was involved with the invention of the swingometer, popularised the use of the term sophology. But he also had a huge impact on televised elections and how that worked.
Way back in 1950, when the BBC did its first election night results programme, he was recruited as the pundit in the studio, the boffin, the election expert, because the man they asked from Oxford didn't feel confident of doing it on his own. He didn't really understand statistics, whereas David did. And he used this device as swing very successfully on television to get the... Not that there were many viewers in 1950, hardly anybody had any television sets. But during the 50s, of course, that shot up rapidly. And he did all the election night programmes for the next 30 years. And he was a bit like John Curtis is now, although actually more famous than John Curtis, because that was the only programme there was until 1959. But more important than that, it's an extraordinary fact that until 1958, broadcasters, radio and television, and of course it was the BBC solely till 55, and then the advent of ITV, broadcasters had this rule that they would, a self-imposed rule, agreed with the politicians, that they would not cover election campaigns. I mean, this is just impossible to believe.
It seems completely unbelievable.
I know, but it's true.
Should we cover this? No.
We'll just
show a picture of a potter's wheel instead. People will like that.
So they'd report that the Prime Minister had gone to the palace to seek an election from the King or Queen. And then the next thing they would report, it would be the result 6 weeks later. And in 1950, Winston Churchill made a major speech. It was the speech, actually, where the phrase, a summit meeting, and he said, when I return to government, I'm going to call a meeting with Stalin and Truman, as it then was, a meeting at the summit. That's right. So the phrase summit meeting comes from that speech. So it was a major speech, this, reported all over the world, Radio Moscow in America and everywhere, only it wasn't reported by the BBC in Britain because it was regarded as an election stunt. Which, to a degree, of course, it was an election stunt.
Imagine a stunt for an election covered on TV.
I'm going to say I really love that. As someone who had to cover elections as well, I'd love for the media to occasionally go, nah, that speech, we don't want to. No, just taking the day off.
But anyway, David thought this was ridiculous, absurd, because he'd spent a lot of time observing elections in America. And he campaigned, partly through his books, for these rules to be relaxed. And in 1958... he convened a conference at Nuffield in Oxford, Nuffield College, and he managed to get there Rab Butler, the Deputy Prime Minister, who happened to be his second cousin, and also was effectively Prime Minister at the time because Macmillan was away, Hugh Gateskill, the leader of the Labour Party, Tony Benn, who was his best friend from university, Joe Grimmen, the leader of the Liberal Party, and the Directors General of the BBC and ITV, And they all spent a couple of days at Nuffield having nice meals and drinks and so on. And they agreed that this rule, amongst other things, they agreed this rule was absurd. And in Rab Butler's words, let's have some buccaneering. And so they relaxed the rule. And 3 weeks later, we had the first election covered on television, the Rochdale by-election in 1958. And after that, election coverage has been actually pretty much like it is today.
Well, that's what I was going to say. We now have the benefit of being able to look back on these old elections. The BBC has excited every politico in the country by repeating them on bank holidays in real time. And what always surprises me is how the coverage is pretty much similar. I mean, yes, the graphics are updated and things like that, but the coverage is pretty much the same. The one thing that always strikes me, though, is that during those early election broadcasts, there was just a huge amount of smoking.
Yes.
This was done, it seemingly, by everyone, yes, all the time during election.
Oh, yes.
There were
people at Wolfsburg. And the other thing is, there was an amazing amount of sexist, what we would regard as appallingly sexist comments on Dimbleby. Richard Dimbleby, the Dimbleby Senior, the father of Jonathan and David, would, you know, make some remark about, oh, there, you know, they're, yes, we've got the pretty production assistants over there. Yes, that's a lovely dress that Samantha's wearing. And how pretty she looks. And all of this. But it was just common currency in television and indeed in society in those days.
You talked about the fact that David Butler was best friends with Tony Benn. He was second cousins of Rab Butler. I mean, more than perhaps anyone else, he's been so involved in the whole political establishment for so long. I mean, I would say perhaps only the Queen rivals that. And
Shirley Williams, actually. It hadn't occurred to me, because I made this point in the book, and then Shirley Williams came to a launch event we had at Nuffield last Friday. And actually, Shirley Williams covers the whole of post-war politics as well, because she worked closely with Herbert Morrison in 1945, even though she was still only a teenager, and has been active up until very recently though she's now retired from the Lords.
So we have Shirley Williams, David Butler and the Queen, and yet it was the Queen that Netflix chose to make a TV series about. I would have preferred the series about David Butler, quite frankly.
David Butler actually appears in one episode of The Crown, and you have reminded me of this fact, and you've also reminded me of the fact I forgot to put it in the book.
Brilliant. So this is a polling politics podcast exclusive.
Scoop.
Exclusive, yeah.
You talked about John Curtis and people like that being public faces, but not as famous as David would have been in his time. Do you think modern academia has somewhat lost sight of the sort of journalist, academic journalist approach that David Butler took?
Yes. I mean, there are still lots of academics on television. Of course, Jane Green did it for ITV, and she's now got the same job at Nuffield that David Butler had. But I think within the academic world, it often doesn't do you much good to do lots of television, because your academic colleagues are often jealous of you. They think you're getting huge fees when the fees are probably a lot smaller than they realise. They think you're
smaller than we realise.
They think you're superficial. If you can sum something up in 20 seconds, well, how can anything be summed up in 20 seconds would be the view of most academics. But, there, you know, John Curtis is obviously an academic too. And there are
Sir John Curtis?
Sir John Curtis, yes, although David got there first. Although it took rather a long time for David to get his knighthood, but he did in the end. Yeah.
Just before we move on, there's the famous Churchill anecdote.
Oh, yes.
Perhaps you could
Well, I mean, David Butler was 25 at the time. He'd just been recruited by the BBC to do their first election night programme, which was being put together in a hurry because they'd never done it before. And there he was working at Broadcasting House. And he got this phone call from Winston Churchill's office, the leader of the opposition, asking if he could go down that night to Chartwell to have dinner with Winston Churchill.
This is the kind of thing that would happen to David Butler.
Well, you don't really turn... I mean, he must have been incredibly nervous, but you don't turn a request like that down, do you? And so he got on the train at Charing Cross and went down to Kent and was picked up. And he turned up at Chartwell, Winston Churchill's country home, and found that there was really hardly anybody else there apart from the servants. And he spent virtually the whole evening with Winston Churchill. Winston Churchill wanted to know about this complicated formula that David Butler had worked out to link the number of votes to the number of seats, called the Cube Law. Please don't ask me to explain it to your listeners. But and Winston Churchill ostensibly wanted to know how the Cube Law worked. But David tried to explain it to him, and Winston Churchill clearly got lost. And so they spent the whole evening talking about politics and history for 4 hours. And there was one interruption when Lord Charwell came in, Churchill's advisor, And then at one point, somebody brought in a little radio and they listened to Anthony Eden making his election broadcast on the radio. And then they commented on it. But, I mean, the idea that in the middle of a general election campaign, 2.5 weeks to go, that the leader of the opposition could spend four and a half hours with a student from Oxford. Well, he was a graduate student, at 25.
Oh, that makes it all right. For,
to spend the whole evening with him. It's just beyond belief. And giving him all sorts of advice, like, you know, oh, you better, you're only 25, you better hurry up, young man, you know. Napoleon crossed the bridge at Lodi at 26. And then at the end of the evening, Churchill leads him up the stairs, the creaking stairs, to the attic room where he stayed overnight.
Yeah.
I mean, it just, you know, it's just beyond belief. But David always says that having spent the evening with Churchill like that, he felt no problems about talking to important... I mean, this was you know, this was someone from history for him, a great hero. And after that, he felt no problems about approaching anybody to talk to them. Churchill also sought his advice later on. They had sort of exchanges of letters, and Butler subsequently went round to Churchill's house in Hyde Park Gate during the 1951 election, where Churchill finally returned to power and found him in bed. And Churchill was trying to explain to him that if you lose a seat, if one party loses a seat to another party, that reduces their majority by 2 votes. But Churchill couldn't get his head round this and was moving apples and oranges on the tray on his bed to try and work this out.
So that's presumably why Churchill never achieved anything in politics.
And then and Churchill then asked David Butler. He said, "Tell me, young man, do you think I'm past it?" And crikey, how would you answer that? Because clearly, you know, he was really. So very diplomatically, David said, "Well, put it this way, sir. Perhaps you're not quite the wonderful asset to your party that you were. Quite the wonderful asset that you once were." And got away with it. So,
impressive.
he would have only been in his early 30s.
That was when he was 26.
Oh, so 26-year-old saying to Churchill that
Churchill was three times his age.
Yeah.
Yes.
Wow. Goodness. Finally, Michael, in a previous episode, and this is for reasons that I can't remember, we speculated specifically about your dancing. Now that you're here, we have an excellent opportunity to actually address this. And so my question to you is...
Unfortunately, this is not on video, is it?
Do you like to dance?
Actually, it's one of those things that I avoid doing if at all possible. But then when I do it, I mean, there was a wedding a few weeks ago that I did do a bit of dancing. And it exhausts me so quickly these days. I mean, I remember at my 50th birthday party, we had lots of Kaylee dancing going all evening. And that was huge fun.
Would you say you have to be dragged onto the dance floor?
Or yes.
Would you more... So you don't happily dance, but only once others are there?
Once others are there. And once I've had a glass of wine or two.
Right. So I think that counts as dragged to the dance floor. I say I'm finally. My question now is about sandwiches. Do you prefer your sandwich as a rectangle or a triangle, Michael?
Triangle.
Ooh, what do you think the British public thinks?
I would have, younger people, I would have thought triangles, and older people, rectangles. But I may have this totally wrong. I seem to remember when I was a little boy, I was only four, and in our village, some workmen, there wasn't a sewage system in our village. And I used to go out every day, this was before I had primary school, and I used to go out every day watching them at work and would spend the lunchtime in their hut with them. And my mother would make me a lunch to take, and they would all be there sitting with their sandwiches. And I think all their sandwiches, the workmen's sandwiches in Northamptonshire in 1963, were rectangular. And I think this triangular stuff is sort of, well, it's a commercial thing, isn't it? The triangular sandwiches. But I don't know, there's something quite nice about putting a wedge into your mouth as opposed to putting a 90-degree corner. I'm going to get into terrible trouble here.
It's the interpretive dance that accompanies this that really makes it. I'm with you. I think triangles are the way to go, but only 28% of the British public goes for that. Rectangles, 60%. Marie, which do you prefer?
I know I complain a lot about people making jokes about me being French all the time. However, on this one, I do have to say that I don't care. I generally just prefer baguettes. I know I will get mobbed, but genuinely, I don't care.
Is there a survey, Joe? I bet if you ask the public, which is bigger, two pieces of bread with a filling cut, which has got more substance to it, they would say one or the other.
That's a good question. There's no age difference, though. So no
age
difference. Okay, that's all we have time for this week. Michael, thank you so much. The book is The Sultan of Swing, The Life of David Butler, available from all good bookshops and Amazons and various other places. Unfortunately, there's no time for our interview with David Butler, but we will just spend the final few seconds looking through the old pictures of election night that are included in the book. Okay, thank you to Subject Bakshi. This episode was sponsored by Smarkets. Thanks very much. We'll see you next week. Please remember to like, subscribe, review, all these different things that help people hear about us. And do tell all of your friends and many of the people that you don't know, even if you haven't enjoyed the podcast. This is a Poddo podcast produced by Nick Hilton, and our theme tune is by Joe Button.
For more details, go to podopods.com, and for sales and advertising, email nick@podopods.com.
And yes, that's spelled P-O-D-O-T-P-O-D-S.com.